Thank you, Brother Hurst. And isn't he doing a good job? You know, one of the things that, and this goes back to Brother King's message about second fiddle. You know, one of the things that impresses me about Brother Hurst is all of these years where he's been second and third fiddle, he just poured himself into this camp. And all, not just him, his wife and kids and the whole family. So it's just a joy to be here and to see that he is following the other leaders before in a desire to have God's presence. And that's thrilling to see. So it's been, I just am so thankful to be here. It's 20 years ago was our first time. My wife and family came. I know the first time and probably the first two. And then she kind of fell off the wagon for the next three. But she's back with me, and I'm thankful for that. So many things to thank you for. All the wonderful food. Cooks are just, they're absolutely fantastic. And the you and the sound, thank you so much. Yes. The lightning's coming on and off. Anyway, those of you that have to do that at your church or do that here, you know that that's a great big job, and you've got to, it just takes, they make a tremendous sacrifice. It just takes their attention to, it's like the cooks, and like the, if we didn't have that, the preacher would have to holler louder, and my voice is not as strong as Pastor David's. And what a joy to be with the Whitakers, and all of your songs have just been wonderful. And then, I've never heard Brother King before, but I now want to hear him a whole lot more. God has really touched my heart. And Sister King's grandparents and my parents were very, very close friends. They went to Bible school together. They worked together in a little mission. I mean, they were just family. And you know, Sister King, you know what I think? I don't know what it's like right now up there. That's all kind of a mystery. But I kind of think that your grandparents and my parents would be pretty happy to see us all serving the Lord and working together. And then, of course, with Pastor David and Jamie and the kids. My, how they're growing. Even Pastor David's growing just a little bit. But it's just we've had wonderful, wonderful times together and expecting more. Thank you for allowing us to be here. And yes, I'm not nearly as disciplined as Pastor David. I took a sneak peek at the check, and Pastor David, it's good. Thank you. And then to be with the Castles. Well, you don't spend 10 years together like we have without one or two things happening, either bringing you together or taking you apart, and thank the Lord it's brought us together. I'm looking in Joshua, and first reading in chapter 24, but I never really thought, I guess, like I should have until fairly recently, about where Joshua grew up. When I thought of Joshua, I just thought of him there with Moses. But he grew up under Pharaoh. He grew up with slave parents. He grew up having to gather the straw, be whipped if you cross the master. He knew what it was like to grow up in misery, where just one movement of the master's hand and you would die. They were, you talk about in a caste system, they were there. They couldn't be anything. And Joshua, he knew the joy of crossing the Red Sea. and getting away from Pharaoh, getting on the journey to Canaan land. He was there with Moses when the mountain shook and it thundered and lightning and fire came, and he actually went partway up the mountain with Moses. The Ten Commandments. He was there. He became Moses' young lieutenant. Second fiddle, by the way. And he played it well. Stood by him completely. He was done with slavery. He wanted the promised land. And even whenever the majority, the ten, when he and Caleb went with the other ten to spy out the land, and the other ten said, "We can't do it. Giants are too big." Joshua said, "We can." And at the end of his life, he's now ready to pass off the scene. And in verse 14 of chapter 24 of Joshua, he tells these people, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord." Now, it's interesting that many of the people he's talking to, now not all of them, because some of them were very small children, but many of them had never known anything about Egypt. Remember, whenever anyone that was 20 years old and above died in the next 40 years? So many of these, they had never known Egypt. And now he's talking about their gods that they that their fathers served on the other side. And he says, verse 15 in the middle of it, "Whither the gods choose you this day." Let me start with verse 15. "And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites, or whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And the people answered and said, "God forbid that we should forsake the Lord and serve other gods." Verse 31, "And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived him, and which had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel." So we now have Joshua, that one that's known what it's like to be in slavery. And we have the generation that's coming after him, that by and large, what they know about Pharaoh, what they know about Egypt, what they know about being beaten with rods and all of that is what Joshua and his generation has told them about. And when he says, "You choose whether you're going to serve God or go back to what your what our ancestors had," they said, we're going to serve God. And they followed him. All that they served the Lord, all the days of Joshua and the days of the elders that overlived Joshua. But now they're coming in, and Joshua's passing off the scene. And this generation that told him that they were going to serve God, this second generation, chapter 1, verse 1, tells us how now after the death of Joshua it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them?" The Lord answered, "Judah shall go up, and behold, I have delivered the land into his hand." Then, if you keep reading through chapter 1, they go up, and remember what God said, "I've delivered the land into his hand." But look what happens in verse 19. "And the Lord was with Judah." God said he's delivered this. It's even before it's happened in his hand. "The Lord's with Judah, and he drave out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron." And when you read, you know that this is not saying that God could not have given them victory. But because of the chariots of iron, Judah felt like they couldn't do that. And later on, for instance, in chapter 2, verse 3, wherefore I also said, I will not drive them out from before thee, but they shall be as thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare to you. Why? Verse 2, you haven't obeyed my voice, and you haven't done this. So what we have with this is verse 19, Judah didn't drive everybody out. Look at verse 21, Benjamin. He goes against the Jebusites, but again, he didn't drive out all the Jebusites. Verse 27, Manasseh. He goes against inhabitants of Bashan, and yet he doesn't dwell. The Canaanites drive them all out. The end of the verse, the Canaanites continue to dwell in the land. In verse 28, when it came to pass, when Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute, but did not utterly drive them out. Now, verse 29, the same thing with Ephraim. Verse 30, the same thing with Zebulun. They went, but every time they failed to completely drive out the inhabitants of the land that God had told them to. So verse 31, Asher, the same thing. Verse 32, the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites that inhabit the land, for they did not drive them out. Verse 33, Naphtali, neither did Naphtali. Now, they definitely brought the enemy under subjection. It wasn't just like that they let the enemy just totally free. But as far as totally doing what God said and driving them out, they settled for the fact that the enemy submitted to them. So when they won the battle against the enemy, and the enemy said, "We give up," they didn't make them totally leave. And sometimes it's because they knew that the fight would be too fierce for them, and yet God had told them they were to do that. Now that's what happens with this generation that followed Joshua. Not Joshua. Joshua said, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord, and we're going to do whatever he says. And when you look at the life of Joshua, he did that all along. We're going to do just what God says, all that God says. The generation after him that promised to do that, they weren't heathen. They were God's people. But now why does God allow this to be repeated over and over and over and over again? I think there's a reason. Now, that generation passed. And let's look at chapter 2, verse 7 of Judges. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of its inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the Mount of Ephraim, on the north side of the hill, Gesh. And also, all that generation were gathered to their fathers. Now, do you see where we're at? Two generations. Now watch. And there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And many of you know that that generation's history is given to us throughout the book of Judges. That generation, when you think of that generation, two different times, in fact, the very last of Judges, but also in the middle of it, two different times this statement is made. There was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And if you want to read something, and you have before, I'm sure, that will just make you cringe, is to read Judges. What happens when every man does what is right in his own eye? Would you help me, Trent? I want to move this over here. This is loose, isn't it? Thank you. We homeschooled for 25 years, and we went to different seminars, and early on, we went to a homeschool seminar, and it was packed, I don't know how many people, 500,000 parents, and a guy named Bruce Wilkinson. Now, Bruce Wilkinson, some of you would be familiar with him, with Walk Through the Bible and his famous little book, The Prayer of Jabez. Bruce was there, and he got up to speak to us, and what he did and what he said, and it's had to have been 30 years, I don't know, a long time ago. What he said has forever impacted my life. What he did has forever stayed with me. And I pray that the Lord would, I'm not going to say all Bruce said, but I pray that God will help us this morning, this afternoon. What Bruce did is he walked out on the stage and he pulled out three chairs. He just set them out just like this. And as a background, although he didn't go into it then, though he has written, and some of you maybe are familiar, where he's fleshed out the three groups that I just looked at. He used, of course, Joshua. Joshua was a first-generation Christian. Joshua represents those that they didn't grow up in Christian families. They grew up, maybe they lived in very, very nice homes and had lots of money, but they knew the slavery that can't hide. Or maybe they grew up on the wrong side of the tracks where they had nothing, but they knew what it was like to be terribly caught in sin. And they came out and they found Jesus. And they represent those that sit in this first chair. Often first-generation Christians, thank the Lord it doesn't have to be first generation. You can sit in this chair second, third, fourth, fifth generation. But they sat in this chair. Now, there's some things to consider about some of them. First of all, they can be very fanatical. Because, I mean, they have found the pearl of great price. They've sold all to have that pearl. They're not interested in having that pearl among other pearls. They want that pearl. They found the value. And they know what it's like to be in sin's prison. So dark and cold. And come out and find the joy of deliverance. And they would rather die than ever get back on the edge of Egypt. I mean, they want nothing to do with that. And they can get pretty fanatical. I mean, nobody doubts what they want to talk about. I mean, they like to talk about other things, but you don't talk very long without these first chair people wanting to tell you what Jesus has done for them. And what he can do for you. First chair Christians, they have found what Phoebe Palmer wrote about, the cleansing stream. I see, I see. I plunge and oh, it cleanseth me. They can tell you how they knew they were born of the Spirit and they sought, and some of them sought for a long time. Some of them sought for longer than they ever needed to have a pure heart, to be entirely sanctified. But oh, they can tell you how. They know how they got clear through. And they want everybody else to. Now, you can know first chair Christians by that. You can know them by what they do with their money. I remember my mother was a first chair Christian. Her brothers, she came from she was never loved. She was the oldest of seven. She was never hugged. She was never kissed. She was never loved. Her brothers were in and out of the penitentiary. My uncles-in-law too, they were in and out, the ones that married the sisters. So, I mean, they were rough fighting people. All my aunts, my uncles, just on and on. And my mother came from that. None of them graduated from high school, but my mother did. My mother found her identity. She loved school, and though her family were on the wrong side of the tracks and were terrible in their life, everybody considered them, you know, right down here. My mother was valedictorian of her public high school. She had a bright mind, and she gave it her all. But my mother, when she found the Lord, she wanted everybody to know that she loved the Lord. And I remember setting, my father was pastoring in a little hardscrabble church and working with the same, what Sister King's grandparents were helping with. And a little bit later, of course, we have quite a few people in the church, but a lot of what people would call liabilities. And we're at God's Bible School, and they're taking this long, long pledging offering that went on and on. Used to the camp meeting, they needed to get that camp meeting was their survival. And they would, you talk about taking an offering to survive, they could do it. And I've seen I watched my parents. And I knew that they didn't even know where they would have money for groceries. And I watched them kind of look at each other and nod. And then they were taking pledges for $100 and they slipped them an envelope. And I knew that my parents would have to pray and scrimp to ever think about paying that pledge for the year. But I wasn't surprised about that because I watched my mother and my dad. They sat in this chair. Now, first chair Christians, sometimes they can be kind of extreme. My mother came out of all of the stuff I just talked to you about, and she didn't want any more of that, so she would have nothing to do with television. Boy, that was back then. Look at it now. And I mean, there was no television, and she was so intense about that, that even home movies, you know, where they used to take the home movies of little children walking around, and then the home movies, you know, were very jerky and all. My mother would not think of looking at one of those. Well, that's pretty extreme. Now, my mother's been dead for many years, 20 years, and she had Alzheimer's, and I've got some of the most precious videos. If we had time, I'd just show you some fantastic stuff of my grandkids and all. I'm glad for that. My mother wouldn't have been able to look at that. You see, first chair people, they don't always have everything understood correctly, but they're marked by a passion to please their Lord. And I knew that about her. I knew that. If you take someone that really loves to hunt, they'll sometimes actually buy more guns than they really need. Even people in music, you know, why do you need three trumpets when you can... I don't know that Trent has three. He might have four. What is it that you really love? What is it that you just really get into? I mean, if I had the trumpets, I'd sell them for money to buy some books. The thing that really we love makes us passionate. And first chair Christians, nobody doubts how they love Jesus. Now, that's true. So occasionally, a first chair Christian maybe thinks that Paul, that was the guy in the New Testament, you know, that also had the name Saul, maybe some, they might think that he actually wrote, or his scribe wrote in King James English. They might really think that. But they sure love what he wrote. That's first chair Christians. We've been where we're at now 35 years. So we were into our pastorate, and the church is a precious church. They were more conservative than I was when I came in to pastor. But as the years have come and gone, I have become very convinced that for the most part, what they were doing was right, and they helped me. They moved me. They actually moved me in my philosophy toward the right. But it's because, Trent, of the first chair Christians. I remember Sister Alberta. She was their treasurer. We have a board meeting. And she shocked me. At the end of the board meeting, very tenderly, she said, "Pastor, I do have a concern." I said, "Okay." And she said, "I'm concerned about our young people being taken to miniature golf." Our church van. Well, the one that took them was me. I had no clue that anybody would ever consider going miniature golfing in a church van would be something the church didn't want to do or worldly. I mean, I could have been blown away. But you see, Alberta was a first chair Christian. And even bringing that up was very, very tender. And I looked at the board. We had maybe 9 on the board or something. And I soon realized in our conversation that the board was not in agreement with her. Sister Mildred wasn't. But they respected her very, very highly. And so we were going carefully about it. And I said, "Well, then let me ask you something. Let me ask the board something." I said, "Then what about if I would just take my family and we go miniature golfing?" And Sister Mildred, a few of you would know her, you know, she said, "Well, now, Brother Smith, that I don't think that would be a problem if you just took your family." I said, "Well, what if my kids took some friends?" And she said, "Well, that I think that'd be fine." She said, "But, you know, maybe just don't take the church van with the letters on it, Bible Holiness." Now, friends, Sister Albert is gone. And I would love to take 3 vans miniature golfing. I don't know how you feel about that, but as far as I'm concerned, it's fantastic. It's great. I like to take the young people. But I told you that story for a reason. You see, Sister Alberta was truly a first chair Christian. And even though I think she was pretty far out there with that, even in that, there was such a tenderness and a compassion toward the young people, toward me. Now, the young people knew that Sister Alberta didn't want them doing that, but I want to tell you what they also knew. They knew that she passionately loved them, and she could touch clear through to heaven. Brother King, a couple weeks ago, we were together there at the other camp, and because of technology today, I'm able to watch all of our services. I've already watched part of the one this morning at my home church. And so my son, Stephen, who now teaches at God's Bible School, and he's now had exposure to a lot more than just our movement. He's taught at Trinity Evangelical School, Indiana Wesleyan. He's rubbed shoulders with, he's PhD in New Testament. You know, he's been out there among all the church world now, those that consider us just real, real weird. But he was preaching, and he referenced Sister Alberta. And you know what he said 2 weeks ago? That his memories of her was the shine on her face. She had a high-pitched little voice, the glory coming. And he knew that that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that some people think that they're sitting in the first chair because they're conservative. Maybe because they don't go miniature golfing or whatever, but they're not sitting in the first chair. Let me tell you a guy that thought he was in the first chair. I had a fella, older man, and whenever there was a need to build a new church, we were crowded out, no parking space. God was blessing the church, growing. We had to have a new church. And he didn't want to have one. Sometimes when if a lot of we conservatives, you know, the one of the things that we don't really care for, it starts with a C and it's not context. It's change. All right? And that wasn't wrong that he had been there for years and years and years. He wanted that church. He could walk to the church we were at. The problem is we were out of space. We're out of parking space. We're ever going to go forward with what God wanted us to do. I knew we needed to build a new church. And so we talked about it as a church and we voted. And it was overwhelming. I don't mean just 52%. But the huge majority felt that way. But he didn't. This guy's gone now. He was deathly against that church. And I remember coming in. He didn't care that there were young people standing around. He was so upset, as he would think righteously indignant. The truth is, he was just angry. And I came into the church, and he couldn't contain himself because he had been there for many, many years. He said, I want you to know something. You're nothing. Well, he might be right about that. But he felt like he was sitting in the first chair because he was standing for something conservative. Friends, that doesn't mean you're in the first chair at all. Now, this second chair often is the second generation. They've never lived with their parents fighting. They've never seen the seamy side of sin in their family, in their mom and dad. They grew up with parents that loved Jesus, that brought them to Kansas State Holiness Camp. They grew up seeing, so I pity the church that doesn't have quite a few first chairs. That's what we have to have. They grew up with some wonderful first chair Christians. And yet, when they hear about Egypt and about all that the one that they respect so much in the first chair talks about, they believe it, but they don't really relate to it. They've just seen first chair Christians. And you know, the people that sat in the second chair, they respect this first chair group. They hold them in the highest esteem. Now, let's look at a few differences. The second chair Christians, they're very good people. They normally come to church. They'll maybe come every revival night, but of course they're busy. And if they told the truth, all during the day of the revival, they didn't spend 2 minutes thinking about it or praying about it. They just knew they needed to get to revival that night. And they prayed a little prayer. If they came to the prayer room, it was just kind of, you know, the tail of it to do what they should. And they pray that God would have his way. And many of them, you know, they're pretty faithful to church, and they tithe. And they give offerings. Some of them real good offerings. But the difference is, the ones that sat in the first chair, everything they have, they just want God to have. They want him to have it. Every bit of it. The second chair, yeah, they tithe. They give some offerings. But, I mean, they've worked hard for their money. And there's things they like. And it's not evil. They're not evil things. And some of them are very successful. And by the way, some of them understand that Paul maybe didn't write in King James English. Some of them get that. And they smile at the first chair people, but they love the first chair people. They respect them. Because if they ever need someone to pray and intercede, they want to go to these people. They want these people praying for them. These people they love. You know, they understand that, you know, it might not even be wrong to have your kids or grandkids little videos of them. And that might not even be bad. Second chair people, they get that. Even sometimes when some first chair people don't. But friends, there's a difference. There's a difference in the way they view life. They love the Lord. Some of them are very generous with their gifts and with their talents and blessing the church. But you won't find them early in the morning just by themselves saying nothing between my soul and the Savior. Search me, O Lord, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. You don't find them just wanting to testify. If you ask them where they are spiritually, they'll be upbeat, but you won't have them standing up with tears and telling what God has done and how He sanctified their heart holy and what a privilege it is to meet with Him this morning and the tears run down. No, you won't. You don't find that. They're good people. They pray. They wouldn't want to tell you how much they pray. They wouldn't be real comfortable if you really saw what they did with all their energy and time. But oh, do they ever love the first chair people. They love to tell stories about those that sat in the first chair that got blessed and just went around the church with a hanky. They don't mind that, Pastor David. They appreciate that. They're not like that because they haven't been waiting in the presence of God and giving all, but they have a deep appreciation for those that sit in this chair. It's just a little too extreme to sit here. You can't sit here and hold on to self. I'm not talking about sinful, bad things. I'm just talking about who's going to be in charge. Second chair people understand that you've got to repent of the bad things and the sins and stop all those bad things. But when it comes to that concept of turning over control to the Lord in all the areas, that's not something that a second chair person is going to do. Now, they can be very, very vibrant. They might even have some really neat Bible studies. And they feel a little sorry sometimes for some in the first chair that are just a little bit naive. And some of them are. My mother never wanted to go back to Egypt. And she didn't care what she had to do to be extreme. But I'll tell you what. Though my mother, I played my mother because, you see, because of her back, because of her pain and her baggage, some parents will do the same thing with their kids that their parents did with them. My mother didn't do that. My mother did the opposite. She affirmed me and loved me and believed in me, and I could pull the wool over her eyes. And one of the tricks that I often would play is when she was wanting me to, when I got to be 12, 13, 14, she was wanting me to do the right thing and come under, I knew I had something I could always do to intimidate her. I'd say, if you think that you're going to make me be a Christian, you wait till I'm 18. And somehow, she wanted my approval. And so she caved in to let me do some things, and things she never knew. I mean, it was bad from the time I was little. But even after I got to be to where I was out drugging and drinking, I'd come in the house, I'd go to bed at night, and she never knew the extent of all the things I was doing. And I'd be asleep, and this happened numerous times. And I would wake up to a sound that I dreaded from the other side of the house. It was a sound of my mother starting to touch through to the throne room. And it made me fear. I never was in and out of the altar. I was a rebel. I tried to lead everybody else that way. But I lay there in bed and began to hear her. She had lost control of me, yes. I don't think that, you know, all of that. It was, but with her background, it's amazing. When you look at her brothers and sisters, it's amazing where my mother came to. But I'd lay there, and I'd put that pillow around my ears. And more than once, on the other side of the house, she would get through to the throne room. And it brought terror to me. I didn't want to be a Christian. You know what she told me after I got saved? And I talked to her about that. She said, son, I'd start praying for you, and the devil would say, he's going to hear you, and he's just going to think you're trying to work something up, and he's going to resent that. And she fought those battles. I would leave after I didn't live at home any longer. I'd come to visit. I'd leave. As I walked out, my mother, with tears on many occasions, would take a hold of me and say, son, I don't know what I'm going to do if I hear that you've been killed. I don't know, son. I know that you've been lost. I said, Mom, I love you, I love you. Out. I knew that lady sat in the first chair. And I knew she loved God, and I knew she loved me, and she loved the lost. She loved people, undesirables that other church people didn't want in their church because they didn't smell right. And they came from too far on the wrong side of the tracks, and they had nothing to offer. She, my mother, was brilliant. I'm just honestly, she was valedictorian. She had a couple college degrees, valedictorians of all that. But that was never anything that meant anything to her. She wanted to reach people that nobody else cared for. People that no other church was trying to proselyte. I was a bit ashamed of that as a kid, but I'm not now. Because she had that. Now, friends, here's the problem with second chair people. They have so much respect for first chair. But their own prayer life is so shallow. They're so full of their own, not bad things, but their own things that they buy. There's people that can't even give to extra things in the church because they have to have this and that and the other, and they put themselves in debt because they have the newest of this. They have to have this and this and this, and it's none of it is bad, but it all was what they just felt they had to have because, you know, otherwise everybody else has that kind of stuff. Second chair people are very conscious of that, whether they have very much or not, and it puts them in bondage. They can't really just give it all. And their prayer life is so shallow. If there's something they need to have prayed through, they call first chair. Please pray for me. And they know if they told the truth, they don't pray. This chair won't pray 5 minutes by themselves. 10 minutes praying by themselves is too much. They're embarrassed. They would not want you to know what time spent. Now, friends, here's the problem, and I'm about to finish. The problem is with this chair. right here. It's that third generation. Remember, there's no king in Israel. Every man does what's right in his own eyes. See, the third chair kids, they grow up in the home of second chair Christians. They respect their parents. They go to church with them, but they've never heard them touch through to the throne room. They've never seen that their pocketbook, their time spent, everything is given over to God. They've never seen that kind of sacrifice. They've never seen that kind of attitude. Parents are nice, but what they see in their second chair parents is just a reliance on the first chair. And friends, then those third chairs, they haven't seen in the home the glory. Maybe their parents are cultured enough that they don't fight and fuss. But they grow up in a home where very definitely these parents live for comfort, as long as it's not bad. And friends, it's the sadness of this chair. No anchor, no glory in the second chair. And there soon, they don't even know. The third chair is just something they've heard about. They've just heard the second chair people talk about the third chair people. Friends, I'm done with a question. Do you know what chair you sit in? There's a lot at stake. And then there's something I say in closing. I've known what it's like to sit in the first chair and have the devil push me, because you don't just sit in this chair and relax. The devil's job all of our life is to push us out of that chair into that one, and then into that. I've known what it's like to be clearly in this chair and have some things in my life happen. Though it caught me blindsided, and I was blindsided. The reality is, the day came, Pastor David, I knew I wasn't solidly in this chair. Oh, a lot of things I was. My little daughter knew it too. And I have a boy that knew it. And I'm not going to go into any of those details. If you're curious, I preached a message at IHC this last year. You can check. But I can tell you this. I'm glad the day came that God helped me to know that no matter what, I had to sit in this chair. And my little girl, she was late 20s, that had been praying for me to get back in this chair. And most people would never dream. I wasn't intentionally out of this chair. I'd just gotten blindsided. But I'm glad God helped me to see that I really wasn't sitting firmly in this chair. My little girl was praying for me. And I went to the church in the darkness early one morning. I'd been praying earnestly to get back in this chair. And God made it clear that I was in this chair. And there was peace. And it was all clear again. And I went to, opened up the door, and the church is totally dark. And I saw a movement up there at the front of the church. And I realized it was my daughter. And she knew I'd been praying, and she came out of the darkness toward me. I went up to my little girl and put my arms like this around her, and I said, Stephanie, my sin, oh, the bliss of this glorious thought, my sin not in part but the whole, is nailed to his cross, and I bear it no more. Stephanie, it is well with my soul. And my girl held me and hugged me and said, oh, Daddy, it's so good to have you back. Friends, you don't sit in this chair and relax. But I just want to say, Trent, whatever he needs to do in my life, whatever he needs to work in my life, I don't care how painful, by God's grace, I want to sit in this chair. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for allowing me to be here. God bless you.